There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's Coolest Conversations podcast time, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is Jesse Wagner, who as a backing vocalist has worked with the likes of Chic, Duran Duran, Lenny Kravitz, and our very own Little Steven. And it's Steven who also recognized her talents as a songwriter and signed her to his Wicked Cool Records label, resulting in her new album, Shoes Droppin'. It features our recent coolest song of the world, Passin' Me By. So let's hear some of that now, followed by my interview with Jesse on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Mighty Manfred here with you for our Coolest Conversations, and my guest today is singer-songwriter Jesse Wagner, who has worked as a backing vocalist with artists as varied as Lenny Kravitz, Chic, Kid Rock, Duran Duran, and our very own Little Steven. How are you, Jesse?
I am good. I'm hanging in there, and just glad to be talking to you.
Oh, thank you. Great speaking with you as well. You know, we spoke, when we last spoke, it was only a few weeks into this, into these COVID times, but now this is like 5 months later. And back then,
yeah, five months, like 5 years.
Yes.
That's what it feels like.
Well, back then, you described yourself as a bling queen, and you said your face mask had lots of rhinestones, and I was wondering, how's that mask been holding up?
You know, I still have it. She still gets out there. I've actually worn her on a couple of gigs that I managed to finagle over the course of these months. But I am a woman and I like my variety. I like options. So I got a leopard one. I got this funky tie-dye-ish pink one. You know, I got one for every occasion. You gotta coordinate. You gotta have a mask for every outfit.
That's right. I forgot. It's all about the accessorizing, isn't it?
Exactly. Which it's like, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. It could be fun and it can show your personality. Yes, it's bothersome. Nobody wants to wear a mask. But if you have to, why not do it with style?
Absolutely. So last time we spoke, I think you were in Norfolk, Virginia. Maybe that was at your mom's. Are you still there or where are you now?
I had to flee my mother's house because I was gaining the horrible COVID-20 or whatever it is. I fled from New York to my mother's house, and then I fled from my mother's house back to New York so I could gain my figure back somehow.
Well, congratulations on the album's release. Been
Thank
out a week
you.
On. You're very welcome. Shoes Droppin' been out a week now on Wicked Cool Records. Were you worried that with the pandemic, it might not even get released this year?
I just didn't know what to expect. Everything seemed so different in January, even in April. You know, there were still, we'll be back by May. We'll be back by June. You know, so you just didn't know what to expect. I remember releasing over and over. I think that's when we talked last. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was hopeful that, you know, something would happen in the summer where I could at least get back and do a couple of shows. And, you know, fortunately we still have live streams and things like that. But I just didn't know what to expect with this thing. And everything is still up in the air. I think being a musician in the time of COVID is one of the more terrifying career paths to have. It's like the end is not in sight. And the other musicians I've talked to are kind of, I don't want to say there's no hope, because I do see people here and there doing these little one-offs, and that does feel good to see some a guitarist and a singer, you know, doing a half capacity type gig, and it's like, okay, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But as far as like getting out in front of a big crowd, you know, we just don't know. There's just so many uncertainties with this.
Well, we spoke before how you were a backing singer with the Disciples of Soul and how you'd met Stephen to get advice on your new recordings. And how he surprised you with an offer to sign you to his label, Wicked Cool Records. And as I recall, you had recorded the new album in between dates of his tour, the last Disciples of Soul tour. Am I remembering that right?
That is correct. And that was difficult because that man likes to tour. He likes to be out on the road. Yeah, so, I think we had like 4 days here, a week there. Yeah.
Well, it was produced by Dave Diamond and Chris Laybourne. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. since you had this sort of a pretty hectic schedule to do it whenever you happened to be around, were they always present or were they with you remotely sometimes?
A lot of it was done, I guess, remotely over phone calls and text, and, you know, they would send me a mix and I would say no, or I'd say I hear this, and, you know, we would tweak, there was a lot of tweaking being done via phone calls and texts. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in those rare moments where I could actually get in the studio, they definitely tried their best to be accommodating for me, because they knew it was always in and out. So yeah, they were great guys as far as trying to accommodate my schedule.
Well, I want you to tell me about these guys. I'm sorry that I'm not more familiar with them. I know Dave Diamond, he's not only producing, but he's also playing drums on the album. How do you two know each other, and how did he wind up working with you on the album with Chris?
I've known Dave for years. He was one of the founding members of my band Army of the Underdog when it was still Envy a million years ago. And so he's just always been kind of a go-to person for me. I love his feel, and he's also a great songwriter in his own right. I mean, if you look up the Dave Diamond Band, he has this cool jam band kind of vibe, and he's good at understanding different types of music and giving it the right kind of feel. So he was definitely, you know, one of the top people I was thinking to go to, because I always liked his own albums. And I met Chris through Dave. They're really good friends. I think Chris has worked, has engineered a lot of Dave Diamond's albums. So I'm the type of person, it's like, if I like you and I work well with you, I'm going to keep coming back to you over and over again for everything. And Dave has always just been that guy that I always go back to. It's the same with all my guys that I've worked with in my band or that I've gone close over the years with. I don't tend to venture out unless they recommend somebody. Otherwise, I keep it really close to home with people I already know.
Well, let's talk some about this week's coolest song in the world, Passing Me By. So you wrote that with guitarist Sherrod Barnes. Is that right?
Yeah, I had actually written it a few years ago. I just never did anything with it. And I just always liked the message of the song. And oddly enough, it's needed more now than ever. And you know, so I think, again, I always talk about divine intervention. I guess divine intervention was like, you need to have this included to kind of balance the darkness of the record and give it some light. And this song is so full of light. And I had a demo of it, but it wasn't quite where I wanted it to be. Sherrod is just so good at finding the right tone, and he's such a brilliant guitar player. Oh, I mean, and it's so effortless for him, because he finds these little bits of candy, is what I call it. Yeah, I have no technical terms, but he knows how to sprinkle the tune with Little Bits of Candy and just make it sound so sweet, and it elevates the song to another level. And so he took my idea, what I was singing to him, and laid down this funky guitar, acoustic guitar. Like, that's perfect. I think he did it in one take, honestly. I don't even think he, you know, we had to go back and do a lot with it. He just kind of went in there and was like, you know, I sang it to him. We kind of practiced it before going in and actually laying it down. Mm-hmm. But when he went in to lay it down, it was like, bam, magic. And it just kind of built from there. And thank God I had, you know, the Disciples of Soul near, like Eddie and Mark Ribbler, as Mark came in and just laid down some wicked slide on it. And again, it just keeps elevating and elevating and taking it to another height, till it gets to the point where it just, it exudes the positive energy that I wanted it to, you know, that the whole song is just about finding that silver lining and knowing that the dark times are going to pass. And I think the musicians got that, and what they laid down came out in the music.
So I'd have to say it's definitely got a very, Passing Me By definitely has a very soul vibe to it. It's like a 60s soul vibe, and it's propelled, I think, a lot by this horn section. You mentioned Eddie Mannion from the Disciples of Soul. He's worked with Steven for a long time arranging the horns. How did you get him involved in the project with that song specifically?
Eddie, I just want to first off say that I love him to death because we're both on tour and we're both, you know, we're tired and we're exhausted and we've been rehearsing and all kind of stuff. And so I sent him these demos and I said, you know, I'd really like horns on these songs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was like, if you could help me out, I'd really appreciate it. And he's like, yeah, I'll take a listen. And the next thing I know, we're on a plane to Australia. I guess we were still doing the Soulfire tour. And he said, Jess, I got it all arranged. I'm like, what, got what all arranged? He's like, the songs. I'm like, songs, plural? You know, he arranged four songs, the horn parts for four different songs on the album. And we're on the plane and he pulls out, he's making notations and he's showing me, he's like, yeah, I'm thinking about doing this and I'm thinking about doing that. And I'm like, how did you do this so fast? And he's like, I dug the tunes and I wanted to get it done. And he got it done so quickly. And what he did was just perfect. It was the right feel for each song. And he assembled the group of horn players. He put it all together. I didn't have to do any of that. He found the right players that he wanted to work with. All I had to do was just book the session and show up. And Eddie had it down. So, I will forever love Eddie Mannion. He's my favorite horn player ever. Sweetest guy. And he's so efficient and fast. And what he comes up with is great. I get it. I get why Steven uses him.
Well, so you got Sherrod coming up with kind of this funky guitar part, you said, and Eddie working the horns. How close is the song to what you had envisioned initially? Is it much different from how you originally thought of the song at all or not?
Well, with a lot of these songs, I thought I was just going to do just me and a guitar, period. And initially, the whole concept was going to be more acoustic. But then once you hear something done, like after I heard Sherrod playing, I was like, no, I want this on it. No, I want that on it. And I could start to imagine it being bigger. And as more instrumentation got added onto things, I was like, yeah, no, this would sound good with this bit. But I never wanted it to go too far. And I feel like we found the right balance. I don't think anything was overproduced. I don't think anything has excessive instrumentation because I still wanted to keep it organic and have that intimacy that you can get with just you and an acoustic. But it has just enough instrumentation to give it energy and to drive it and still keep the intimacy. So I think it's excelled beyond what I had envisioned initially. I was floored with how it all turned out. I mean, it's one thing to have something in your head and then to actually hear it actualized. You know, I think I started crying at one point because I was like, wow, this is, it's becoming real and it's beautiful.
Well, I love how you describe the songs, you know, wanting to have this organic feel, but enough instrumentation to kind of, anyway, the way you phrase that, I agree with you 100%. It really great production throughout. Let me ask you, how old were you when your grandfather passed away?
Oh my, wow. I was older. I wasn't a young girl. This was only a few years ago. I think he passed maybe, I think it was 2014.
Okay. Make sure we get the listeners in here with us. So you sing on Hard to Let You Go about the passing of your grandfather. I was wondering, the more you sing that song, does it make it easier to resolve letting go?
I haven't sung it live yet, and I don't know if it's because I'm scared to sing it live or, just haven't been able to find the right way to work it into a set. It's funny because the guy who wrote the guitar part, Kieran Sullivan, his friend had just passed, and I believe my grandfather had just passed, and I think that's when I heard the music, and I know where he was coming from that place, and then knowing the kind of pain I was feeling, it just... that's where the melody came from. And I remember we did like a snippet of it on an Instagram post because we were working on it, and I didn't feel like I was going to break down, but I felt the loss, and I was saddened, but I know he wasn't in pain anymore. My grandfather, he died of pancreatic cancer, and he was in a lot of pain when he passed. So it was almost like a blessing for him to finally ease that and move on. But yeah, I haven't had a chance to perform it yet. So I don't know how it's going to affect me now, going back to it. Honestly, I haven't even really listened to it that much on the album. I think maybe I'm a little afraid of it, but I remember singing it at his funeral and I got a little choked up, but I was able to get it out, and I think it would have been a song that he would have liked. I think he would have appreciated it. I think I'm getting a little choked up now. So yeah, I'm gonna have to add it into a set list one of these days and see if I feel him smiling down on me. But I'm pretty sure I will.
So early in the lyrics to "Hard to Let You Go," you mentioned being selfish for not letting go, and then in "What You Get Is What You See," you mentioned both you and your love being selfish, and those are different kinds of selfishnesses. But that had me wondering, so how much selfishness is necessary for art and the artist, and then how much is too much?
Ooh, that's a deep one. I think to do what we do, you have to have a little bit of selfishness because your career... it does take top priority in a lot of things. And you hope people understand that. Like I've missed my best friend's wedding. I missed holidays with family. So, you know, somebody could view it as like, you're putting your career over, you know, all these other things. And it, in some ways, yes, but in other ways, it's like, that's the nature of the job. You kind of have to accept what it is if you want to succeed and continue to work in this kind of atmosphere. So I think it does require a little bit of selfishness, but you hope you have people around you that understand where it's coming from and are willing to work with you through it. I think I also, with those songs, especially with "What You Get Is What You See," "What You Get Is What You See" definitely deals with me looking at myself, the truth of myself, and not what I want to project and not what I want the world to see. And I noticed that I could be a little selfish. I would spend more time worried about my needs versus my partner's needs, or just self-absorbed in what I was going through with my career versus, you know, what he might have needed from me. And I had to step out of myself and say, okay, no, you are being this way. You have to own up to it and accept it and try and work with this person and try and compromise, because it can't always be about you. So it's kind of like trying to find that balance with this career, because it does require a lot of attention for it to grow. It's such a difficult path, and you have to be so focused on getting to a certain point. And sometimes, you know, people get lost in the shuffle with it. But I'm learning, I'm trying, you know, and that was another reason, you know, I had to write "What You Get Is What You See," because I do see that in myself. I do see the growth that I need. I'm not saying that I've gotten there. I know that I have a lot of work to do, but I recognize it, and I know I need to work on it. I'm going to work on it. I'm going to try and be better.
Absolutely. You know, life is a work in progress, I think.
Yes.
So you do a video for the album track, My Darling, My Dear. That was a live show at the Bowery Electric. So you streamed a show from there recently? When was that?
Wow, yes, September 11th, we did the live stream from Bowery Electric, and it was cool to be on a stage. It's like, when was the last time I was on a stage? And to have a full band and have the song realized, to have the majority of it, its potential, because it has the instrumentation that you originally heard, you know, in your head. And it just was such a warming feeling. And again, to be on stage, it's like, this is where I belong. It was odd too, because we're performing to a camera. So, yeah. You know, the whole time I was doing the show, every time we would finish a song, I was like, okay, wow. And I would be my own applause. Just to, you know, again, give it a little levity, give it a little fun. But just because the silence is unnerving in those kind of situations, you know, you're used to feeding off the audiences. And when there's no audience, it's like, who do you feed off of? I try to take from the people around me on stage with me. And that's how we make it fun. But, you know, our venues are struggling. Our venues are trying to keep alive, you know, for the day that when people can come back and perform. So to be able to do a show at a venue and let people know, hey, we got to support these places so that, you know, when we can come back and congregate, they're there for us. And, you know, we don't want any more of these places shutting down. So it was nice to have that aspect of it too, that, you know, we're giving some business to this place. Mm-hmm. I'm on a stage. I'm with a band. There was a lot of moments of exhilaration just because, you know, having that atmosphere again, being on stage again. It was also a little nerve-wracking because I'm like, wow, you sing differently when you're with a full band than you do when you're just with a guitar or by yourself. So, you know, you got to, you know, get those rusty pipes going.
One thing I liked when you're singing in the midst of the performance of the song, I wouldn't know that there's no one there, right? It looks like the shot of the frame has got the band there on stage, and you know, you're moving around and you're singing and you're moving your hands here and there, and I would think that you were like just in front of a live audience, you know. So I mean, it came across really well is what I'm getting at, I suppose, here.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, well, when you're on stage, I mean, you feel at home. At least I feel at home, and I'm always going to try and give every little piece of myself that I possibly can when I'm on stage. So I'm glad it came across.
So over the course of the album, over the course of Shoes Dropping, I think there are like 11 songs, and you incorporate all sorts of different music flavors, blues and soul and R&B and folk and rock. And, you know, all this gumbo is sort of a product of your varied music likes and influences. Now, trying to pick a favorite doesn't seem fair to any of the children there. Were any of the songs like a problem child you really had to work on? And then when it came together, you're like, ah, man, this worked out way better than I thought it was going to be.
Yes. I think the hardest song was Caretaker. And that was definitely one of the hardest to write because of the honesty behind it. And it was, that's definitely one of my more vulnerable songs in the track on the album. I think it's actually one of my most vulnerable songs, that one and Great One. It because I have this particular cadence to how I'm singing it.
Yeah.
It had the rhythm section had to match it perfectly, or it had to balance it perfectly. You know, it's one thing to sing in your head and get the idea, but then actually deliver it just right. it took a little practice. I had to sing it a few times down before I actually got my cadence right, so that the music fit. And I think we had to recut the guitar. It had a lot of challenges to it. And then I recorded the strings at the wrong tempo and had to kind of recut things. And but then I remember going in. And again, one of those moments where I just kind of burst out in tears. And the cello player was in there recording his parts to Caretaker. Mm-hmm. And that one just took off in a whole nother level that I had no idea it could go. The whole song came out in a way that I never really expected. Dave, he took it in a different direction than I had initially thought. And I was about to fight it, and then I was like, okay, let me give it a chance. And I let it, you know, kind of wash over me. And as it was built and the cello came in, the other instrumentation came in, I just remember it was like, this is beautiful. And it became my favorite song on the album just because I didn't think it could go there. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the song, I'm like soaring, you know, I really feel a release, you know, because it's hard to be that honest. It's hard to be that real. And I think that song is like the perfect release of so much frustration. And then the way that it came out was just so beautiful. So it was a problem child for all these different reasons, but it just came out so beautiful with the strings and everything. I think that's probably one of my proudest songs.
It was a problem child, but with love and nurturing, it blossomed.
Yes, it did. Yes, it's a perfect way of explaining it. And it's definitely, you know, top three.
So have you been doing any recording for other artists over these last several months, like backing vocal kind of stuff?
Yeah, I actually do a lot of dance records on the side. And there was another one that actually did really well this summer, which kind of shocked me. It's a group called Puzzle Room. The song is called Back to Life. And it got like over 300,000 streams. So I was floored. I couldn't believe it. So the dance music's kind of been keeping me alive. It's been another source of income, and it's been a way to be creative. And I have a great engineer where I can go and lay down my vocals whenever I need to. And yeah, it's just been a great outlet to have the dance music.
Very cool. So about the dance music, so is that you as the featured artist, or is that you contributing to other artists' recordings?
It all depends on what they want, but I do have a lot of featured artist credits out there, like the Puzzle Room song, Back to Life, that is featuring Jesse Wagner. So yeah, if you go to my Spotify, you'll see a few different featured Jesse Wagner on these dance tracks. So yeah, I'm kind of a chameleon. I do it all.
Well, that's how you stay afloat. You know what I mean? I mean, you talk about the
exactly.
career and musicians having to figure stuff out, and you've already got this great sort of frame of reference or perspective, you know, having a finger, a toe in all kinds of different music genres, and that it only makes sense. And being a chameleon certainly does help.
Yes, definitely. But it's true. That's, you gotta be open-minded with this kind of career choice, because it's a lot of it's feast or famine, and you got to take the gig when the gig comes around. And you know, if you're snubbing your nose up, you may not be eating that month. So,
it's different to want to get rid of the COVID-20 as opposed to not having the COVID-20 on there and starving. So yeah, well taken there. Right now, we can only play one other track off the new album, and I want it to be the title cut, Shoes Droppin'. And my notes tell me the song comes from a pretty dark time in your life. Can you tell us about that? What was going on?
Yeah, Shoes Droppin' happened, it came about when a family member underwent a cardiac arrest. It was actually my ex-husband. From that point on, we didn't know if he was actually going to survive. Mm-hmm. And it became the most difficult 2-3 years of my life, him fighting back to find himself, basically, because after the event happened, you know, the neurologists all thought he was going to die. So a miracle in the fact that he fought back from the brink of death to learn how to walk again and talk and breathe, all of these things. But it was a really difficult journey for him. And it was a difficult journey for me trying to be there for him and still work and be present in this chaotic experience of rehabilitation. And there were a few points where it got overwhelming for me and for him. There were times I just thought I couldn't take anymore. That's where the music came. I think the music brought me through it. And there were times I even questioned, you know, my faith in God and my belief. But now that I look back, I think that's why God sent me the songs, because it was a way of release, again, a cathartic experience to process my emotions during that time. And Shoes Dropping, it's just like the title says. It's like, you know, the old saying, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Right.
And I felt like every shoe was dropping. You know, it's like, I don't have to wait for it. It's already happening. It's so, you know, I was just begging God. It's like, please, I can't take anymore. I need mercy. I can't stand any more shoes dropping. And that was kind of like the starting point for a lot of the other songs and for me to want to put together this album. So it was kind of a burden when I was writing it, but now it's become the seal on that whole time period up to now. Mm-hmm. It's like I started from tragedy and worked through it and found a sense of peace and hope.
So that track kicks off the album. You know, it's, I mean, I love the song, the calling out to God and questioning what's happening to you and even your relationship with God. And it's definitely got the gospel feel to it and very bluesy. But it begins the album in this very dark place. And you just mentioned how it was sort of a starting place for a lot of the other songs that followed. What was the intent of putting that track first?
I think, again, because it was kind of a catalyst, and I knew I wanted to name the album Shoes Dropping, mm-hmm. So I did think that would be a good way to start it. And then as I was looking through the catalog of songs that I was putting on the record, then I was going through, okay, what would feel better coming after it, and what would, you know, I just tried to go by feel for the rest of it, but I also wanted it to have highs and lows. So I think that's where the sequence came in as far as thematically and through the feel and tones of the songs themselves. So it brings you up, takes you down, and kind of flips you all around, and then at the end you find acceptance.
Has your ex heard the song? Is he familiar with it?
I don't know if he's heard Shoes Dropping yet. He has heard other songs from the album, and he said they've been great. I know he likes Lover's Lullaby. That was written for him at that time, mm-hmm. And he always said that was a beautiful song. You know, he's sent his congrats, and he's been very supportive with all the songs I have released. He hasn't heard the full album just yet.
Jesse, thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. That was quite a roller coaster too.
All right. Well, let's hear that title track to the new album, Shoes Dropping, is Jesse Wagner here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
What have I done to deserve all this? Been brushed by death on misery's kiss. My path not always a straight and narrow. But I kept my eyes upon his old sparrow. This burden has gotten too hard to bear. Tell me, Lord, are you still there? Mercy, hear my plea. Mercy, hear my plea. Mercy, hear my plea. He's up on the sinner. He's up on the sinner. He's up on the sinner. Cause I can't stand no shoes dropping.
Shoes dropping. That's the title track to Jesse Wagner's debut album on Wicked Cool Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Jesse for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And join me next week when I will speak with Chris Payne of the New York City band The Midnight Callers. They have a new album out on Gem Records titled Red Letter Glow. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.